Hey, everybody, I'm Evan Farmer, and welcome to Disaster Diaries. I'm here with my co-host, Andy, and we're here to interview people who have literally lost everything and survived to tell us how they rebuilt.
I'm Andy Krueger, the CEO of BuildSOS, a disaster resilience company, and we're diving into the human side of disaster recovery.
All right, so thanks for tuning in, and without further ado, let's jump into today's episode.
So, Jeff, thanks for coming on. I was realizing when I was thinking about this, I know obviously so much of Kathy's experience with Katrina because I was there for some of it, but I've only heard little bits and pieces of, you know, what happened with you in Pensacola, I believe it was, right? In the storm and all that. So what was life like before you had this happen? How long had you been in Florida? You know, did you have any experience with disasters? I mean, how did you come up on this thing? How did it all kind of happen?
I mean, I can go all the way back to my very, very early childhood living in Key Biscayne, Florida. I mean, if you live in Florida, you are used to hurricanes. Now, generally, they haven't been catastrophic, but hurricanes are just a fact of life if you live on the coast, either the Atlantic coast or the Gulf coast. I lived in Gulf Breeze, Florida, which is a suburb of Pensacola. It's on a peninsula, so you're literally surrounded by water on three sides, which becomes Pensacola Bay. And also the inland waterway. You've got a very narrow barrier island out there, which is Pensacola Beach. It's a quarter of a mile wide, basically. And it runs basically the length from Pensacola all the way to Destin, Fort Walton Beach. Fort Walton Beach and Destin and beyond, Panama City. So you have this barrier island that's out there that is barely above sea level. A lot of it has been developed. We lived across the inland waterway, a mile of water between where I lived on the water in Gulf Breeze and Pensacola Beach Barrier Island. So generally, the Barrier Island took the brunt of any hurricanes. We had several hurricanes. We moved there. I moved there in 98. Literally the day we closed on the house in 98, we had a hurricane, Hurricane George. You know, it might be every 2 years or something like that, every 3 years, you would have a hurricane come by. They didn't necessarily have to make landfall where you are. You know, the dome, particularly the wind dome, the water dome, but also the wind field stretches out a good distance. So we would feel hurricanes that were always going through the Gulf, like heading to New Orleans or heading to Mobile or east to Panama City. And you would still get flooding, but not anything that most people weren't prepared for. The barrier island might go underwater a little bit. The streets would get flooded and things like that. In 2004, Hurricane Ivan had churned around the Gulf. I think it had already made a landfall somewhere, maybe Tampa-ish or something like that, but then it came back out. And I may be confusing that one with Charlie a little bit, but again, so, you know, we had multiple hurricanes. Literally, there were years. In 96, Opal and Aaron both hit Navarre Beach within a month of each other. You just never know where it's going to come ashore. You always hope that you're not on the right front shoulder of the thing, because that's where the maximum winds are, which pushes the maximum water in. Anyway, so our situation was we were a mile off the barrier island. We lived right on the water. I had a 400-foot dock that on occasion would go ahead and get damaged a little bit, but could always repair it just fine. So Hurricane Ivan is coming up now in the Gulf, and they didn't think it was going to be that bad. I mean, it was just going to be another hurricane. And so, you know, people were making plans. A lot of people evacuated Pensacola. They left if they had a place to go. I had my wife and my two daughters. I sent them to Atlanta. And I intended to stay in the house. That was my plan, just board everything up, secure what I needed to secure, and just be ready to spend the night in the house while the hurricane blew through. That was sort of the typical thing to do. But as the day progressed, the storm hit at about 2 or 3 in the morning. But as the day before progressed, they were starting to talk about this dome was becoming massive. It was very much bigger than other storms had been. So that started to get a lot of people nervous. But I had put up all my shutters and had my cold six-pack of beer and all that ready to go and just watch the storm from inside my house. But about 5 in the afternoon, they made an announcement. I had a little radio that they were going to shut all the bridges down at 6 o'clock. That would have completely stranded me on this peninsula. The only way to get out of there would have been a long, long drive down to Navarre and then up north through the Pine Barrens, basically. So I decided to go over to Pensacola to a friend of mine who had evacuated to Atlanta. He was a fellow Delta pilot. And he had said, if you need a place to go, you can use our house, because it was up on high ground in Pensacola. And so at the last minute, that's what I did. It's a good thing that I did. The storm came through middle of the night. I basically slept through it. I heard maybe in the middle of the night, one crack and a boom, but that was about it. I woke up the next morning as the sun's coming up, and I look outside and just massive amounts of live oaks down. It took about an hour with a chainsaw to cut my way out of the driveway just to get out to a road that I could try to get to my house, because I was obviously very interested in what happened. I finally got down to the Pensacola Bay Bridge, but they had just closed it. That was one of the main ways over to Gulf Breeze. They had just closed it, so no traffic could go across the Pensacola Bay Bridge. There are obviously sailboats and big boats, power boats up on the highway. I mean, you could tell it was very significant. I go and I reverse course and I drive north to try and get around the north end of the bay. And I get to I-10, and I-10 is shut down because literally they had 17 feet of water, knocked the I-10 bridge out. It also took a truck, a semi tractor trailer had driven off when the bridge went out at that point in time. So again, I head north even further. And this is all going on over the course of a couple of hours. And I finally get around the top of the bay, having to leave the road quite often to get around trees and things like that. And I was able to get to what's called the Garson Point Bridge, which was east of where I live by about 5 miles. Just as they were closing that bridge, I begged them to let me follow. A cop was heading across the bridge, and I said, just my house is right there. I can almost see it. Just let me follow. So I did. When I got to my neighborhood, I could not believe the destruction. My entire street, everything on the water was destroyed. I mean, houses literally moved across the street. I got to my house, and my house was a complete blow through. The roof was still there. The foundation was still there. The studs were still there, but everything in the middle was gone. I had 7 feet of water come through the house.
The roof was still
and
on?
That, the roof was damaged, but the structure was still there.
Wow.
Okay. It was almost like they were halfway building a house. They had the roof studded out. They had the walls studded out, but there was nothing, no plumbing, no electricity, nothing. Everything that was in the house had literally been washed out of the house and had washed down the street and down the golf course. And I could literally tell, okay, there's where Aaron's bedroom went. Oh, there's the living room over there. There's, I mean, literally fields of debris. Pockets of debris that here's where everything was. But there was nothing left in the house. Everything was essentially flushed out. There were a couple of people in the neighborhood that had two-story houses. Mine was a one-story house on a slab. There were a couple of people that had two-story houses that had stayed, and they had very interesting stories about the night of the storm, about how the water came into their house and literally chased them upstairs. You know, they couldn't even get out of their house. They were trapped in their house. There were some people that had stayed in one-story houses in the neighborhood that literally got trapped as the water's rising. They could no longer get out of their house, and they would have to climb up on their kitchen counters and bash their way through the ceiling to try and get up into the attic to avoid drowning. We were fortunate. We didn't have any fatalities in my neighborhood or in Gulf Breeze. But that was just very fortunate, because most people had the sense to evacuate. I hadn't. So now I'm back in the disaster area, and I'm one of the few people there. And now I realize this is going to be very, very difficult, because obviously there's no food, there's no water. They shut the power, the gas, the water, everything off. And so you're literally out there camping with nothing but your car, quite frankly. But I was determined to try and recover anything that I could recover that I thought I might be able to save at the time, which turns out to be worthless, because almost anything that has touched seawater it's not going to survive. Ultimately, the salt, the acids are going to deteriorate it. So, you know, but I tried to save a lot of pictures and mementos and things like that. I had boxes of that stuff full of sea mud for years, actually, you know, in my attic.
You were actually walking around that morning, you were there and looking for pieces of your house and of your kids' stuff and collecting what you could. What was that like? I mean, absolutely. Just wandering around outside looking for your stuff.
It was being in a disaster area, complete disaster area. The only people that I saw at that time was a military helicopter that was kind of flying around. They gave me a wave, but that was it. I spent the better part of 2 nights, 3 days right there at my house. And I had to forage for food. I mean, I had to go into other people's destroyed homes and see if I could find something to eat, find water, this, that, the other thing. There were looters, had people that were out there going into houses and walking out with stuff. And I had to decide whether I was going to confront them. And here I am all alone. I was armed, but here I am. You know, there's 5 or 6 guys looting my neighbor across the street. I saw them, they saw me. But you just have to worry about that. I mean, that's the situation in a disaster area, is that people are going to come in there that aren't there to help you. Okay. Yeah. They're in there trying to pick up stuff that they can. And everybody's house was wide open. And as a matter of fact, the storm took about 4 blocks in. All the houses that were on the water were destroyed. But even 4 blocks in, houses had multiple feet of water into them. Everybody's house was essentially exposed and open. After the third day, I decided I wasn't going to sleep in my car anymore. And I was going to go ahead and go back to the house back in Pensacola that I had spent the storm night. And gosh, it took me probably 5 hours to do what otherwise was a 30 or 40 minute trip to go back to that house. But so my days after that, for almost 2 weeks, were essentially going back and forth each day. I would sort of go in. Now, the National Guard came in and set up checkpoints and stuff like that. They would let you through the checkpoints to get to your house if you showed them your ID that you had an address there. You know, people started flowing back in after about a week. And I mean, literally, you could hear the screams as they arrived at their houses. I mean, you could just tell, okay, they're just back. And they're, now they're trying to adjust to everything that you've, you know, looked at for the last week. One of the biggest issues was gasoline. There was no gasoline anywhere on our side of all the bridges. And so every day, now I'm using a generator and, of course, some power tools, you know, chainsaw, things like that. And just the struggle to get gasoline became almost the priority, that every day in the morning, I would get up as early as I could and I would stand in line for an hour or two at the 1 or 2 gas stations that had generators that could still pump gas. Most of the gas stations were their generators. They had no electrical power, so they had no pumps, so they couldn't pump the gas, even though they had gas in the tanks. So, I mean, that became a big deal, is you would stand in line for an hour or two or more, and then they'd only give you 5 gallons. They're rationing the gas. So you had just enough gas to power your generator and your tools for that day, basically, or maybe 2 days. And then you were right back in line to try to get another 5 gallons. It took about a week before you started to see aid come in, FEMA, some of the churches.
A week. Did you have any local, anybody helping out from?
I'm sure outside of our area, probably, but we were the hardest hit area. We were the destroyed area. And so, you know, they were just not able to get stuff in and out. For us, it was about a week before they started. They finally set up a command post area over in one of the parks in the parking lot, and they would hand out cases of water and a box of MREs, the meals ready to eat, military meals. And so at least you had water and meals now. And then, you know, every day it got a little better. You started to see different community groups come in and hand out food, you know, for all the people that are now coming back and trying to address what they had and what they were doing. You know, the initial shock, I mean, you lose some things. Most stuff doesn't matter. If you really get down to it, most of the stuff in your house doesn't matter. Thankfully, nobody's hurt. But everybody has a few things. You know, photos are very important. I had a piano that had been in my family forever that was very important. And that was slammed through the front door. And it met my boat coming the other way. So there, it was all just a huge conflagration. You know, things that were mementos. Those are the things that I think back on and say, you know, that one hurt a bit. All the rest of the stuff, it doesn't matter. You get over that, you move on. And so that's the next phase, is once you kind of get over the shock and realize there is no way you're getting back in your house anytime soon, because now you got to start running the gamut of what's it going to take. You got to get the insurance company and adjusters, and they're overwhelmed. They had hurricanes from Tampa to Texas at the same time that Ivan hit us. It was a couple of weeks before we could even get an adjuster to come and look at the damage.
When was your first call to the insurance company? I mean, was it just once they knew your address, they were like, yeah, everything's gone?
My first call was within a day. There was a pay phone that was working. One phone that I could find that was working. You know, we didn't have cell phones at that time. So there was one phone at the CVS, the outside of the CVS. And so I had to call I was flying for Delta at the time. So I had to tell them where I was and what was going on. And they were very understanding. And I called USAA. And they said, we're going to have somebody out there as soon as we can. But I mean, it was a couple of weeks before an adjuster came out. In the meantime, you know, you're just sort of left stranded, honestly.
How old were your kids at this time?
My kids were about 6 and 8. And so, you know, they're having to deal with everything they owned gone. This is sort of a silly story, but my younger daughter was very, very attached to Beanie Babies. She had quite the collection of Beanie Babies, and everyone was a friend to her. When I got there and I'm walking around in the muck, and that is what it is, it's muck. It can be a foot deep, it can be an inch deep, but you're just in sea muck with all this stuff out there that has flowed a half a mile down the golf course with everybody else's berms of stuff piled up. But my daughter was so attached to those Beanie Babies that became a mission for me. I was finding her Beanie Babies because they do float. And so I was collecting bags of Beanie Babies that were in the sea muck. And after I would drive back that night to the house on the bluffs, I would spend an hour or two cleaning them in a tub of water and soap and hanging them out to dry. And so that became sort of my mission, you might say, a little bit. It was the one thing I could do. There wasn't a lot of else that I could do that made a difference at that time. So if I could put a cap on it, I would say I should have evacuated, not worried about anything, any of the material stuff, and just returned a week or more later when they started getting at least some services and water and food, and at least the roads were opened up enough that you could get through, because there was nothing that I really did that mattered, that made any difference in the long run. The next big challenge, so here you have the disaster, you get overwhelmed, but you get over that. The next thing is, where are you going to live? Where are you and your family going to live now? Because you're not getting back in your house anytime soon. So now it becomes a big scramble for people who have kids in school, for people who have jobs, you know, right there in the local area. They can't just up and leave. We had a condo in Atlanta because I was flying for Delta in Atlanta. And so, you know, my daughters and my wife stayed there for a couple of weeks. But I was very, very fortunate that I had a neighbor, my next door neighbor, whose house was also destroyed, who had just literally completed construction on two houses that were up on a bluff in Gulf Breeze. So they had not been damaged, and they had been built to hurricane code because they were brand new, and they survived just fine. And so my good friend Augie said, I'm going to take one, you can have the other. What a blessing that was. We were so lucky. So here we are. I'm able to say to my wife and daughters, just get a U-Haul, hire people to go ahead and load up all the furniture from the condo and just come on down. My wife's brother helped with that and all that. And so within 2 weeks, we were moved into a house now. So we're starting to at least get back to life. The kids can get back to school. And I have a place that I can go now address, you know, the destroyed house. Some people had to move, you know, 30, 40 miles away to find places to live. So that becomes the second stage, you might say, of challenge. Then the third stage is, okay, so what are you going to do? Are you going to tear it down? Are you going to rebuild? Can you rebuild? The can you rebuild, it becomes a huge question because there are so many building codes, especially in Florida, especially near the water, that you can't necessarily rebuild your house, even if you want to. And that was the case of my house. If a house is more than 51% damaged based on its appraised value, which is the tax collector's appraised value, which usually people like to have a lower value, right? Well, this is the case where it hurts you because that 51% line is based off of that. If you are 70% damaged, okay, like my house, the roof was still there. The foundation was still there. The studs were still there. I could probably have rebuilt my house, except that the cost of that was going to be more than 51% of the appraised value. Therefore, under Florida law and under FEMA guidelines, it's really FEMA that says this. So this is a national thing. This isn't just Florida, I should say. Your new house to get a permit to build, to rebuild or repair has got to meet all current codes, no longer grandfathered. My house was about 20 years old. So it was grandfathered back to the flood levels of 20 years ago and the electrical codes of 20 years ago and the building codes of 20 years ago. So that meant it doesn't matter what I wanted to do. The house had to be torn down. It was a total loss in terms of how the insurance company looked at it, how the county building inspectors looked at it. That took a year to get through, an entire year before that all got ironed out. And yes, the house got torn down. Everything got taken out. Now, the next thing is, okay, so what are you going to rebuild with? Do you have any money? How fast can you get your insurance money? Well, in these large disasters, it's not very fast. You're going to get some money to hold you over, to tide you through based on the type of policy that you have. But that's just enough to kind of pay for where you're going to live in the meantime and cover some of the expenses and maybe cover the expense of tearing the house down and having all the debris hauled away. But the reality is that you now have got to go through the process of adjusters coming, and they're going to adjust, and you're not going to like the adjustment. And it's not going to be as much as you need to rebuild the house, especially if you're now having to rebuild to new codes, which for my house, I now had to put my house up on pilings. That adds about 25 or 30% to the cost of rebuilding the house. Well, unless you've taken what in Florida was called law or ordinance insurance, which is an extra 25% on top of your policy to cover that gap, you're not going to have the money to rebuild. And so a lot of people find themselves in the bind that they don't have the money to rebuild. They've got this piece of property, maybe on the water, and now they've got to make a decision. I guess I have to sell the property and leave.
Did you ever think about that, just taking the money and walking away?
I did. My circumstances were a wee bit different, though, because right at the time that this happened, I also took early retirement from Delta for different reasons. Delta was going to declare bankruptcy, and that means the pilot pension plan goes along, yada, yada, yada. I had the choice to go ahead and take my pension lump sum, but it meant I had to retire. None of this was planned. If you had talked to me in August of 2004, none of this was planned. But in September of 2004, I lose my house. And in October of 2004, I'm no longer employed. I am now retired. So I had the luxury of going anywhere that I wanted to and not being tied while I wanted to rebuild my house on the water. So I spent the next 4 years fighting it out, might be the word, but having to work through all of the everything that it took to optimize every part of my insurance coverage. Literally, you have a dwelling policy, but you also have a contents policy. To get that contents policy, you have got to write down every single thing you lost, every pencil, every pair of shoes. That's a mind-bending experience because you have to think back of everything that you lost and receipts if you got them. And if it's high ticket items, yes.
Did you write down anywhere like an asset list ahead of time or pictures? Or
the only thing we had done was we went around and took pictures of each room, like took a shot of each room, which is something I highly recommend people do. Because you don't know if your house is going to burn down in a fire. This is not just hurricane stuff. A fire will put you in the same position, right? If at least you have a photo showing all four corners of each room, you have something that you then can go and mentally start to make that up. But there is definitely a very involved process that the insurance companies go through when you're trying to claim large ticket items. They're going to want some proof of that large ticket items. A photo will help you, like the piano that I lost. You know, I wanted to go ahead and claim the piano, but I had to prove that I had the piano. So I had to show them the photos of the demolished piano in the doorway and bring pieces of the piano in to show them what kind of piano it was. It's things like that that tend to be a full-time job for a while. So a lot of people who have to work, you know, like within a week or two of the hurricane, they have a very hard life for them. Because they're going to have to go through that very same process. And you're going to have to get a lot of estimates from people. You're going to have a lot of contractors come in and give you estimates. You may hire what's called a public adjuster, who is somebody that comes in and does an adjustment, just like the insurance company's adjuster. So that becomes a competing adjustment. That's how you gain the leverage to get the maximum value of your policy. You also get into this situation where you have a dwelling policy that covers the dwelling, but it doesn't include flood. So now you have a flood that destroys the house or destroys half the house, let's say. And so the insurance company is sitting here going, we don't cover the flood part. So the first 6 or 7 feet of my house, they're not going to cover under my dwelling policy. But everything from 7 feet and up now, that becomes part of the dwelling.
Just, it might be worth mentioning that Jeff became an attorney after he retired from Delta. And so I'm thinking, Jeff, were these the 4 or 5 years where you were in law school, and did this motivate you at all to to do that, to take that path?
Yeah. Let's just say I had a real world education on the insurance laws and the insurance situation. I ended up going to law school about 6-8 months later. I was in law school. So yeah, of course you take insurance law, but trying to explain, particularly to the professor who wrote the book on insurance law, this situation, he even said to me one time, he said, Jeff, you're probably the only person I know that knows more about insurance than me, because I lived it. I lived how you have to go through this, and you have to be organized, and you have to detail everything, and you have to be patient. You have to be willing to say, no, that's not good enough. Now, a lot of people aren't in that boat. I was just very fortunate because of my circumstances. A lot of people are desperate to get their houses rebuilt, especially if they are repairable. So they will end up probably accepting less than the full policy limit. You know, that's just the nature of your circumstances. If you want the money and you want it fast, you're probably going to be settling for less than the whole amount. But every time they came to me with another spreadsheet of here's what we're going to give you, I basically sat down with them. I said, no, that's not right. I can prove this. I can prove that. I mean, my house, literally, I had to get an engineering study. I hired an engineer for a $5,000 study to show that the wind actually lifted the house. There were areas of my house where about halfway up the brick wall, there were pieces embedded inside the crevices of the back. So I said, no, that's not flood. Flood was coming up from the bottom. That's wind. lifting the house. And that happens because you have tornadoes. And we were able to show that there were tornadoes that came between my house and my neighbor's house that lifted, literally put upward stress that this debris got in. And so that's how I got a lot of my policy covered under wind, which otherwise, if I hadn't done that, they wouldn't have paid me for a lot of the damage that was in that middle area. So, I mean, this is what you learn going through the process.
This is interesting because when I went through my disaster, one of them, there were insurance attorneys standing outside on my lawn before the fire was even out. Knowing what you know now, would you hire an attorney to represent you on an insurance claim, especially of this magnitude? Because it sounds like you were doing essentially what an attorney would do, which is figuring out all these things, saying no when a spreadsheet comes in, and fighting. Because it sounds to me very adversarial what you went through, and mine was certainly. Would you hire an attorney or recommend that to anybody?
I will say that an attorney is helpful if you get to the end of the process and the insurance company is flat not paying you now. I mean, they're saying this is it, but you still feel you have an adjustable case. The attorneys are not adjusters. Whatever they say about damages does not matter, honestly. What matters is the adjuster that comes in from the insurance company. And unfortunately, what happens, even USAA, which is a good company, considered probably one of the best in these situations, they were having to hire outside adjusters just because they were so overwhelmed. So it wasn't even USAA adjusters doing the initial adjusting. And so I was fighting them. I was fighting these adjusters. But the only way you can fight them is by getting a counter adjustment. And that's where the public adjusters, now they come in and they will take a chunk, okay? But they can only take a chunk of the difference that they gain you, okay? There are some that are unscrupulous. In Florida law, they can only take, I think, 10%, maybe 20% of the gain that they get you. I had others come in and try to get me signed contracts that they were going to get 10 or 20% of my total. That's illegal. So you will see people coming in. You got to be very careful because you will get contractors, certainly unlicensed contractors, flowing in from all over the place. And they're coming in and they will do jobs for cash. They won't pull permits. They'll do the work and sometimes they'll just disappear. I had some good friends who got like a $20,000 check. Their house was not on the water. They got a $20,000 check. One of these guys said, contractors came to the door and said, I'll fix your house for $20,000. Signed over the check to them. Never saw the guy again. It's that kind of stuff that goes on in these crisis situations where there are people who take advantage of you. So you work with the adjuster. A public adjuster may be worth the money. Or if you just get a good contractor, he doesn't have to be a public adjuster. Just have a relationship with a contractor. And they are so busy because, of course, a lot of people are trying to line them up now. But if you can find a contractor that can help you. Now, if you go to an attorney, he's sitting here going, well, there's nothing we can litigate at this point until the insurance company has completed your adjustment. The only thing they might be able to do is they may have a few contractors on speed dial that they'll work with. Okay, so maybe that could be a benefit. But quite frankly, most attorneys, you know, they're going to take a fair chunk to go ahead and do this. So I wouldn't dive into an attorney until you've hit the end of the road. And a lot of people hit that. There were a lot of insurance companies. There are insurance companies that go out of business. And so now you're left basically as a creditor of an insurance company. And that's probably going to require an attorney or an insurance company that's just flat not giving you what you truly believe in your heart and can prove is the difference. At that point, an attorney, and this is usually going to be a year or two later, can get involved and start to, you know, make claims specifically against the insurance company. That'll sometimes break the logjam right there. Ultimately, in Florida law, there is what's called bad faith claims. This is where attorneys like to get. If they can prove that your insurance company is intentionally trying to shortchange you, they can file for bad faith under Florida insurance law. And that goes into triple damages if they win. That's why they love it. And the bad faith law threat is a huge one for insurance companies. Usually, if an attorney is filing, there's a 90-day waiting period and stuff like that. But once an attorney files a bad faith claim, you all of a sudden are now in a completely different category as far as the insurance company is concerned. They're going to make sure that they have dotted the I's, crossed the T's, or paid you whatever they can stand to pay you, because they know that's going to be a trial and that's going to be triple damages, and that can be huge loss for them. So it really depends on your insurance carrier. This is where you don't want to find a budget carrier, because they literally go out of business in situations like this. If they have 1,000 policies in that area, that probably wipes their reserves out and they're going to declare bankruptcy. And then you're waiting in line with everybody else. You might get something. You might get 50 cents on the dollar, that kind of situation. So the big carriers are obviously more capable of withstanding this kind of situation. But because of the situation where I wasn't even trying to get back in my house for the 3 years of law school, I just continued to kick it back, kick it back, kick it back. And ultimately, they finally said, I'll give you full everything. You just tell us where to send the check. And that's what happened. And so I was able to get every single pocket of the policy, because the policy's segregated into different pockets. And you can max out some things, but you haven't maxed out the policy at all. Contents, but also other things. Rebuilding costs, the cost of new construction, depending on what your policy was, you may have an extra 25, 30%, but you're going to have to go ahead and prove that you're rebuilding to the same standard, all that kind of stuff. So it's a complicated process. And then, of course, rebuilding is a year to a year and a half. I had neighbors that were back in a house in 2 years, but they probably had to come out of pocket more than they had to if they had been willing to wait and fight it out. But their priorities were different. They had kids in school and they really needed to get back into a house. And we were just very fortunate that we had our little house up the street, compliments of my friend, that we had no pressure.
I'm thinking about the cell phone thing, right? And the lack of cell phones. So your wife and daughters thought that you were staying in the house, right? Two questions, I guess. One is, how did that pan out where they looked at the news the next day, the neighborhood's wiped out, and hey, dad was there? And also, how did it go for them the years afterwards? Because one of the themes that's come up earlier in some of our conversations with other folks is there's a significant difference, or there can be, between how different people react to it, especially if you're the one taking the brunt of the organizational piece. There's also the emotional element of going through it. So how did that all go?
Well, first of all, I had told my wife that she was very concerned about me staying in the house for the hurricane. I was there right up until the last minute. And I said, oh, don't worry, I'll just put on my pilot helmet and sit in the bathtub. I'll be fine. Thank God I didn't do that. It was gone.
What happened to the beer?
I've been floating down the golf course with all the rest of the debris. You know, I called them the next day from the payphone over at the CVS. You know, I basically said, hey, everything's gone. And that was a shock, obviously. There were a lot of tears. I do think about my daughters. It's traumatic. It's definitely a very traumatic experience to be a young child and all of a sudden lose everything that you have. My wife and I can rationalize it like it was just stuff. And that's what you have to do. The house can be rebuilt. You can rebuy everything. And unfortunately, we did. We filled the house up with junk again. A lot of people obviously had huge psychological problems coming back, seeing their house, not knowing what to do, and realizing they're homeless. It was not easy. I had to face the fact that that day that I showed back up, we hadn't left thinking it was going to be a lot. We didn't take the computers and the cameras and the stuff. I mean, we just didn't think this was going to happen. So we had but the clothes on our back and one suitcase of clothes, and that was all we owned at that moment in time. And that's what people are in. When you see people sitting there on the destroyed doorstep of their homes, that's what they're facing. Everything is gone. What they have to do is say, it doesn't matter. I'm alive. My family is safe. We're going to work through this. go find a safe place to live, and then just start going through the motions that you have to go through. The biggest thing is you got to train your mind and say, it's not going to be fast. You got to plan for the long game as to where you're going to live and get settled so that you keep your sanity about it all. You can't live in a hotel for 6 months. You can't have your kids disrupted from school for 6 to 12 months. You've got to find stability again, and it's just not going to be in that piece of property right now. That's what you have to mentally do for yourself. Now, I was in the military, so I've seen disaster areas. I've seen areas that have similar, you might say, characteristics or similar difficulties and people in similar situations. So for me, I kind of, okay, mush on. But I would say for the wives and the children particularly, oh yeah, there's long-term traumatic stress that comes out of this. And it is something to recognize it. And it's something that a lot of people should get therapy to help them through that, because it becomes something that is baggage inside. You become very tied to your possessions, afraid of leaving things, afraid of change. There are definitely psychological things that happen when you've gone through an experience like this. You become much less tolerant of stress, because you've kind of hit your stress max. And that's why I say a lot of people should be thinking truly for their kids and for themselves, do some post-traumatic stress therapy.
I remember after Katrina, the thing that hit me years later, I didn't realize it at the time, was that you have a certain assumption, kind of quiet assumption you never question, about how bad things can get, right? And usually you don't look inward to see what that actually is, but it's there somewhere, right? From your childhood, your life experiences, you feel like, okay, here's the range of how bad things can get. And I remember after Katrina, right afterwards, thinking consciously, wow, I didn't know societies could, or micro societies, cultures, cities could deteriorate this fast. I didn't realize this is how close we are at any point in time to looters and to all the rest of this. And then I think that's conscious, but I think long-term, as I look back on it, I wonder if that floor falling out, whatever that layer, that bottom was of, this is the worst case, it drops down. And when it drops down, everything you've built on top of that, of who you are, you need to take a look at it again. And if you're not actually looking at it, if you're facing forward and that's all happening in the subconscious, there could definitely be some ripple effects there. So
I have a good friend here, who his house burned down in Texas about 6-8 months ago. I think about the people in Los Angeles. I think about the people in Maui. I mean, a fire will do that very thing in a few hours and leave you in the same spot. Mm-hmm. Everything is gone. I cannot save anything. And so you really, at that moment in time, you have to address your own materialism and say, you can live without all of that, and you're going to survive and move forward. And that's exactly what I told him. I said, it's only stuff. As long as nobody was hurt, it's only stuff, and you can buy plenty of stuff. So, but it does make you recognize what's more important, what's most important.
And that's the difference between post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic growth. So if you can, you know, take that stoic mentality and get through it, whether through therapy or great friends. Because I remember I had life before the fire, and then there's life after the fire, and I'm not the same person, and it's not really a negative for me anymore. I'm not attached to things. And so when I have up and moved my family, you know, across continents, there wasn't the attachment that I used to have. And I was able to hopefully teach my children the same thing. So I hear what you're saying. So Jeff, I have one question that we ask everybody for our listeners at the end of every podcast, and I'm curious to hear your answer. I think I have a sneaking suspicion of what you might say, but it's, what would you say to someone listening who just lost everything 5 minutes ago?
Well, if you're lucky and you believe in God, say a prayer and move forward, because God's got you. That helps a lot. Otherwise, just say, it's going to be a challenge. I'm going forward. And, you know, this is where your backbone works, right? And especially if you have a family that you're trying to, if you're on your own, that's one thing. But if you have a family, you're going to try to get stability back for your family as quickly as possible. And that's not material things, but it's just a roof over your head, get back to as normal a lifestyle, start eating well again, start being healthy again, because this is going to be possibly one of the biggest stress events like in your life. You're going to survive it, but you got to move forward.
What an inspiring story, man. Thank you for sharing that with us. Even reliving it, I could see, especially talking about the Beanie Babies, man, that one hit. It's never easy, even this many years away. So I really appreciate you taking the time to dig deep.
Well, thanks. I'll tell you, I was applying for law school very shortly after the storm, and you have to write a personal statement about who you are, you know? And it's a big part of getting into law school, especially if you're 50 years old. I wrote about Beanie Babies. I wrote about the perseverance of recapturing what little I could for my daughter, because that became something that kept me going. I wasn't wandering aimlessly in the muck. I had a purpose. I had a mission, because everything else was junk. But I could save those little Beanie Babies. And in doing that, I could bring some normalcy back to my daughter. The one big thing that I miss is I spent 20 years as a pilot in the Air Force, and my flight jacket went somewhere and I could never find it. And that's the one thing that I mourn. I do mourn that, but can't replace it. But that had a different meaning than all the other stuff in the house to me. But that's just the way it is. And like I say, a fire will take everything in an instant. And you can't save much after a fire. You know, it's all destroyed. So for people who go through this, it's really important that they understand sort of the phases that it's going to take, but also the mental part, the internal part.
That was great.
Yeah. Good talking to you guys.
Hey, thanks for listening to Disaster Diaries. And if you're moved by these stories that you've heard, please subscribe, leave a review, and share the show with someone that you think needs it. And to tell your own story, download the Disaster Diaries app, available at all app stores, or visit disasterdiaries.com. And if you're looking for help rebuilding, check out buildsos.com for support, tools, and resources to help you better prepare for, respond to, and recover from disasters.